I have a question. Is God fair? Is God fair? Have you ever else asked yourself that question when you're going through some kind of trouble, when you're going through some difficulties? You know, when we look at this world, the world in which we live, the world in which we have to become a part of or are a part of, it's fairly certain that it isn't fair. There isn't really liberty and justice for all in this world, is there? And even in the church, sometimes there seem to be some inadequacies. Let's go to Matthew chapter 20 this afternoon as we begin. Matthew chapter 20. And I hope that as we go through this, we can go down a road that hopefully will explain to us so we can understand why God allows the world to be in the place it is in. How he allows certain situations, even among brethren, to sometimes be so different. Matthew chapter 20 and verse 1. Matthew 20 and verse 1. For the kingdom of heaven is like a landowner who went out early in the morning to hire laborers for the vineyard. At that time in history, that work day started about 6 a.m. 6 a.m. in the morning, or you could say at first light. He goes on to say, now when he had agreed with the laborers for a denarius a day, he sent them into the vineyard. Again, this is a normal wage for a day, a denarius. And he went about the third hour, around 9 a.m. He went back out and saw others standing idle in the marketplace and said to them, you also go into the vineyard, and whatever is right I will give to you. So they went. Again, he went out about the sixth hour and the ninth hour. So noon and 3 o'clock, right? That's where he's going, every 3 hours. And he finds out that there's more laborers waiting to be hired. And he did likewise. Verse 6, it says, and about the 11th hour. So here we are, an hour before the day's done, right? 1 hour before, you know, the whistle blows, punch your clock, you're out. He says he went out and found laborers standing idle. And he says, why have you been standing idle all day? They said to him, because no one hired us. He said to them, you also go into the vineyard, and whatever is right, you will receive. So when evening had come, the owner of the vineyard said to his steward, call the laborers and give them wages, or their wages, beginning with the last to the first. So the ones only that worked an hour were in the front of the line, right? They're in the front. And then it went back to the last ones that were hired, all the way through that day, everybody who worked that day. I want you to imagine you're standing in that line. Okay? You're standing in that line with those people. Verse 9 says, and when those who were hired about the 11th hour, they had each received a denarius. Now again, you're a little bit further back, right? You had been there maybe half the day, maybe 9 hours. Maybe you were there all day. And so you're thinking in your mind that, hey, if this guy that came and worked 1 hour gets a denarius, well, man, what am I going to get? Right? I worked all day long. I worked all these hours. You know, I should be making a good profit from this. Sounds fair, doesn't it? Sounds reasonable, at least to you and me. Verse 10. But when the first came, they supposed that they would receive more. So here we are, the guy at the back of the line, the first one out at work that day. He comes into there and he thought he would receive more. Again, would we not expect that? We've been there all day. We've been working all day. Would we not expect to make more than the guy who showed up an hour before work was over? I think we would, wouldn't we? That's just the way things go. And it goes on to say, and they likewise received each a denarius. And when they had received it, they complained against the landowner. Again, perfectly understandable. Is it? Is something like that happened today in this world? At your jobs, there would probably be a picket line, wouldn't there? There'd be unfavorable work laws or labor practices. That's what would happen. And they said, these last men have worked only an hour, and you made them equal to us, whom have borne the burden and the heat of the day. Equal with us. Think about that for a moment. Because what I think about is, you know, those people are going to be called at the last moment. We've been spending our whole life doing this, haven't we? And they may be called at the last moment. Is that fair? I mean, I'm just trying to put things in perspective a little bit. Right? We're human beings. We have that proclivity to think like that. That's our human nature, isn't it? But he answered to one of them and said, "Friend, I am doing you no wrong. Did you not agree with me for a denarius?" I mean, that was the agreement. That's what you agreed to. When I asked you to go to work in my vineyard, that was it. You agreed to it, and you thought it was a fair wage when you agreed to that. Take what is yours and go your way. He goes on to say, "I wish to give to this last man the same as you. Is it not lawful for me to do what I wish with my own things? Or is your eye evil because I am good? So the last will be first, and the first shall be last, for many are called, but few are chosen." So how does this parable help us understand how God works with his people? What can we learn from this? Or what are we supposed to learn from this? You know what verse says? It says, "The kingdom of heaven is like." So could it be that we're supposed to learn from this parable that God works with each of us individually? Right? He works with us individually. He doesn't promise that our individual circumstances are going to be any different than somebody else's, or they're going to be the same as somebody else's. It could be comfortable, or it may not be comfortable, but they're going to be different. He deals with us individually, in our own life, in his own time, and in our own circumstances, where we are. God promises us salvation and a place in the kingdom of God for all eternity. Right? He promises that to us. For all eternity, to be a part of his family, to be one of his sons and daughters. But he doesn't promise to bring us boldly out of the situations that we're in this life. Or the trials that we go through. He doesn't promise that. He doesn't promise to take us out of, again, any of the difficult situations we might find ourselves in. And sometimes that's even family problems. He doesn't tell us that. He doesn't promise that. He does offer us help. We all know that. He offers us help in many different ways. In wisdom through his Spirit and guidance through his Spirit that he's given to us to make those situations better. To improve them as much as we're able. But he doesn't promise that our situation is going to be just as good as anybody else's situation. This is what we learn from this parable. But there's another thing that we also learn from this parable. At least it brings to my mind, is that everything belongs to God. All right? Everything belongs to God. Remember what the master said here. Is it not lawful for me to do what I want with what's mine? Right? If I want to be gracious to this person, you're telling me I can't do that? Everything belongs to God. He created us. He owns us and everything around us. You and I know he created us for a special purpose, to be his sons and daughters in his kingdom, and he can take care of us as he sees fit. He knows what we needed, and we committed ourselves to him at baptism, didn't we? We said there are no strings attached. If you don't remember that, think about it. No strings attached. We said we're no longer ours, but we belong to him, and we leave our lives in his hands. In 1 Corinthians 6, verse 19, you don't need to turn there. I'm just going to read it. A passage that you know, you've heard many times, but it says, "Do you not know that your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit who is in you, whom you have from God, and you are not your own? You were bought with a price. Therefore, glorify God in your body and in your spirit, which are God's." We now belong to Him. We have been given our lives to God. We promised that there wouldn't be any conditions attached to this at baptism. No conditions at all. No strings, no obligations. About the working conditions of being a Christian. He never promised that we'd be equally or better treated than anybody else. But humanly speaking, we have this innate understanding of what fairness should be. Or do we? And sometimes that bothers us. That bothers us. Of course, fundamentally, we must believe and trust that God is doing the best for us. He wants the best for us. And we should all, I think, we hopefully all agree with that, theoretically. I mean, do we believe that? Do we understand that? If I asked you, do you believe God is doing everything for your best interests? Would you say yes? But when we start to have difficulty, we start to have issues and problems and go through trials, sometimes it isn't quite fair, is it? It's not fair that I have to go to do with this. It's not fair I have to deal with this. And we start to wonder if this is really the case. Let's look at Hebrews chapter 11. Hebrews chapter 11. Look at verse 6, Hebrews chapter 11, verse 6. "But without faith, it is impossible to please Him. For he who comes to God must believe that He is." Now that's pretty simple. We've all been in the church a long time, but that God must exist. We hopefully have proven that. All right, that He exists, but we also must believe more than that, don't we? We have to believe more than that. We must believe that He is the rewarder of those who diligently seek Him. Again, in 1 John 4:8, you don't need to turn there, but it says that God is love. God is love. That means He wants what is good for the rest of His creation. All of us. All of it. In fact, Luke chapter 6 and verse 35 says that God is kind to even the unthankful and the evil. Remember last Sabbath I said that He even gives rain, the sun to go up and down and rain to the evil. But this, it says that He will... is kind to the unthankful and the evil. God works for the good of every part of His creation. And He is a rewarder of those who diligently seek Him, those who follow Him, those who do what is right in His eyes, and we can put our lives in His hands, knowing that He will work what is good, that good work within us. In our rather superficial comparisons, and I didn't realize that what I sent out in my note, Sabbath note, was going to even come here, but comparisons, and we're talking about assuming, right? I said assume. We shouldn't assume because we don't know the details, do we? It's just like comparisons. We start wishing that our situation was like somebody else's. But God works with us individually. He is going to do the best He can for us in the long run. You don't know what's going on with that person. So how can you wish or compare yourself to him hoping that your situation is like theirs? Maybe they're going through something you don't even know about. As we'll go on here, we'll see that it's not right to compare ourselves. Let's go to 2 Corinthians chapter 10. 2 Corinthians chapter 10. And we're going to go to verse 7. Hopefully this will shed a little bit of light on what I'm talking about, because it talks about avoiding the trap of making comparisons among ourselves. Because our comparisons often lack certain elements of information and understanding of what's really going on with somebody else. So we can't be accurate, can we? We cannot make an accurate comparison. There's no way to do it. And so here we find people complaining here when we look at 2 Corinthians about the Apostle Paul and his preaching. 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 7 says, Do you look at things according to the outward appearance? And really, it's very hard for us to do otherwise, isn't it? You know, I've done that many times. I see somebody come in, maybe the first few words, and I'll make an assumption like that. And it's usually wrong. I mean, I've learned not to do that. I'm not saying I do that with everybody I meet, so don't worry. I'm not doing that here with you all. But do you not do that as well? We make assumptions very quickly. And we say, oh, that person's going to be like this, or that person's like that. That's just our human nature. And we do that. And we tend to look at what we see, don't we? But we can't see the heart of people, but God can. God sees the heart. So if we're starting to make comparisons, which we do, they're going to be very superficial. Going on, it says, if anyone is convinced in himself that he is Christ's, let him again consider this in himself, that just as he is Christ, even so we are Christ's. For even if I should boast somewhat more about our authority, which the Lord gave us for edification and not for your destruction, I shall not be ashamed, lest I seem to terrify you by letters. For his letters, they say, are weighty and powerful, but his bodily presence is weak, and his speech contemptible. So apparently there was a comment the church members or church member had made at the time they were making, no doubt, again, that during this time, where they were not in the best attitude. Paul didn't seem to have a lot of charisma. Right? He didn't. Physically, that is. He didn't have a very strong presence on the stage, as we read here, so to speak. And his speech was not rousing and exciting. You know, it was probably just, you know, plain. But it says his letters are fascinating and deep. So some people were making comparisons about the Apostle Paul. Let's go down to verse 11. It says, let such a person consider this, that what we are in word by letters when we are absent, such we will also be indeed when we are present. For we dare not class ourselves or compare ourselves with those who commend themselves. But they, measuring themselves by themselves and comparing themselves among themselves, are not wise. So it's not wise for us as human beings to get caught up in making comparisons. We end up being discouraged because we don't measure up to the other person. Or we can end up feeling more superior. And I will tell you this. When I first was moved to Salt Lake City, I couldn't help but compare myself to John Pinelli. And I thought, man, these are some big shoes to fill. How am I ever going to do it? And it bothered me for a year, probably a year or better. And you can even ask my wife, Cheryl. She thought, how am I going to measure up to Debbie Pinelli? You know Debbie Pinelli. Bubbly, just bouncing off the walls, beautiful spirit, just always going and happy and friendly. And we came to realize that they're not us. Why am I comparing myself to them? God gave them their gifts, their talents, their abilities, but he gave me my talents, my gifts, and my abilities. I just need to be me. I don't need to try beating anybody else. But that's what happens to us sometimes. We get caught up into that comparing one another. Oh, I need to be more like that person. No, be yourself. Now you can build on your strengths and abilities. And hopefully that's what we're all doing in this time that we have. But look at yourself. Right? Don't compare with anybody else. Oh, I wish I could speak like him. Or I wish I could lead songs like him. Or I wish I could... No. Work on what you have. Be yourself. Right? That's what we need to look at. We need to keep our eyes more on God. Right? On God in our personal relationship with him and how he's working with us individually in our lives, in our own circumstances. What is he doing with me? And not worry about so much how he's working with other people. That's our human nature and tendency. Well, what are they doing? Well, what's happening with them? Why? Who cares? You know, God loves all of us. God is working with all of us individually. We have to worry about myself. That's it. Individually, work with God. That's what we're to do. He measures against ourselves. Do you realize that? He measures us against ourselves. He knows our potential. He knows what abilities we have, what skills we have. He knows what we're able to do. He knows what we can do. And that's what he's measuring us with. Are we living up to the potential with his help and his guidance by submitting to him? That's kind of the comparison God makes. That's how he looks at it. You know, we're preparing to rule. We're preparing to reign with Jesus Christ. And we're learning to do that by being obedient in various circumstances and situations. God is checking us. He's looking at us. He's wanting to know what decisions we make, how we make those decisions, what's going through our mind, what's going through our heart, and where that takes us. We need to remind ourselves that God is allowing us to be where we are. He's allowing it. He is allowing us to be in our families. He's allowing us to be in our jobs or the lack of a job. Sometimes for a while, that happens. Or whatever we are, God expects us to be faithful no matter what. Let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Back a book, 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Because here verse 13 tells us that God is involved in every circumstance. Even the difficult ones that occur in our lives. 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 13. No temptation has overtaken you except such as is common to man. In other words, if you're going through a trial, right, in your life, you're going through a difficult situation and you've had a difficult time overcoming it, others have had to face the same similar trial. We're all sort of learning the same lessons, I guess you could say, when we look at this kind of thing, but in different ways as life goes on. It goes on to say, but God is faithful, so you can count on him, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will also make a way of escape, that you may be able to bear it. So even in the difficult times, when you're saying, I can't continue, I can't do this, when our lives are not as easy as we wish they could be, or maybe think they should be, God says, I'm not going to let you cross the line. I'm not going to let that happen to you. I will intervene. I will change things so that you'll be strong enough to deal with it. And ultimately, I'll make you a way of escape. We don't always find the way of escape as quickly as we'd like, do we? Sometimes it takes a long time. Sometimes we never find it. But sometimes we have to bear with it a while. We have to hang on, and sometimes a long while. Is God fair? Well, much longer sometimes than we'd like, isn't it, to hang on. But God is involved. He is there. He will not allow you in a situation to become too hard for us. He won't allow it. Now, you think it's too hard. But he knows you better than you. And he knows what you can take. Let's go over to Romans chapter 8. Romans chapter 8. You know, I find these scriptures are very moving to me. They have a lot of deep meaning, and I really think there's implications in all of them that how we can deal with our lives. And they're very encouraging. Romans chapter 8 and verse 28. Romans 8, verse 28. And we know all things work together for the good to those who love God, to those who are called according to His purpose. What this verse doesn't say is that everything that happens to us is the very best thing that could happen. Because we make mistakes, don't we? We sin, and God allows that because ultimately, we're going to learn a lesson. Well, at least I hope we learn a lesson from the mistakes we've made. And we're supposed to learn how we're supposed to live our lives the correct way. And that turns to our good, doesn't it? Learning the right way, learning the correct way. It turns to our good. That's what this human life is all about, isn't it? What we're going through. The best thing is when we obey God, when we follow God, when we listen to God, and we learn from the good things that happen in our lives. That's the best way life can be. But we can learn either way, can't we? We can learn either way. We can sin and learn. And we can do what's good and learn. We can do both things. We can break laws and pay the penalty and say, oops, I guess I shouldn't have done it that way. Probably wasn't the best way to do it. Or we can obey God's laws and reap the rewards, right? And say, man, that worked out great. But again, both ways, we learn the lesson. But when you put 1 Corinthians 10 and Romans chapter 8 together, we understand that God ultimately is involved in our lives. He's tweaking things. He's changing things. He's intervening to make sure that we never are be tested beyond what we can bear. And to make sure that all things work together for good when we love God and are called according to His purpose. That's kind of a hard statement to believe sometimes, isn't it? And humanly speaking, there's times when I say, I don't want to hear that. I'll be honest, I have said that before. I don't want to hear that. I want it to stop. I want it to be over. How can you say that this pain in this painful situation is for my good? Well, life can be pretty scary at times, can't it? But when we read the Scriptures, God's Word, He tells us and we realize that our Father is holding the rope. He's holding that rope, and for those of you who've gone rock climbing, maybe went to camp somewhere, He's got the rope. He has it in His hands and He says, I'll never let go. There may be some jerks along the way. And the rope once in a while, and we may even slip. You know, that happens. But He will never let go. You know, when we talk about difficult circumstances or the lack of fairness or an apparent lack of fairness in life, in our lives, in terms of the Bible, probably the story that I look to most and think about most is Job. Right? Job. Talk about fairness. Let's go look at Job. Let's turn to Job chapter 1 and verse 1. Because I look at this and I think, I don't think he did anything to deserve what he got. I mean, really, when we look through this, we'll find this out. We'll just hit some high points. Here, Job chapter 1 and verse 1. Job chapter 1 and verse 1. There was a man in the land of Uz, however you want to pronounce that, whose name was Job. And that man was blameless and upright and one who feared God and shunned evil. Man, I would love God to say about me. What an incredible description of a human being. When you think about it, from God. He says this about Job. He was blameless and upright, feared and shunned evil. So he was quite a man. In fact, God even brought Job up as an example of what his servants were like. Right? What his servants were like when he had this discussion with Satan. Let's go to verse 6. Verse 6 says, "Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them." This is one of the questions I have for God or Jesus Christ at some point is, you know, there's a lot of things I'd like to know, but did they talk often? God and Satan? I mean, you know, you just read this. I mean, what was that like? I'm curious. I don't know. Just something I thought I'd just throw out there, I guess. But here he's talking with Satan. He says, "And the Lord said to Satan, 'From where do you come?' So Satan answered the Lord and said, 'From going to and fro on the earth and from walking back and forth on it.' Then the Lord said to Satan, 'Have you considered my servant Job? There is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil.'" Now I want you to think about that. God talking to Satan and says, Have you considered my servant Mark? Have you considered my servant Cheryl? Have I considered my servant and put your name in there?" I mean, think about this. He did it with Job. Could he not do this same thing with all of us? Certainly he could. He sure could. Nobody like him. I mean, nobody like him. "Have you considered my servant Job? There's none like him." So God brings up Job to Satan. "Look at him." And I sit down here, what is he doing to me? "Look at him. He's one of my best servants. There's nobody else like him in the world. He just really stands out." You think Satan likes that? Absolutely not. Well, we see the next verse here. Well, actually down in verse 9. Satan reveals a little bit about his, I guess you could say, his psychology. How he thinks. Verse 9. "So Satan answered the Lord and said, 'Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge around him, around his household, and around all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But now stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you and curse you to your face.'" This is how Satan operates. I mean, he's thinking Job is going to say, "Well, what's in it for me? Right? What's in it for me? You know, I want something right now. I'd better, you know, better work and get things to my advantage so I can get what I want, or I'm not going to participate." That's what he imagined Job to do. Satan, what do you think he thinks about us? If you take away all the good stuff, he's telling God, if you take away all that stuff you've given him, he will curse you. Because why? You won't be useful to him anymore. Satan didn't realize the kind of character that God is building with his spirit in his people. Verse 12, it says, "And the Lord said to Satan, 'Behold, all that he has is in your power, only do not lay a hand on his person.'" Now I want to stop there because you saw what he said up here, but now stretch out your hand. Face, the Lord said, "Behold," God didn't do anything, did he? People will say sometimes, "Well, God made this happen," or "God did this to me. God is making me suffer." No, he is not. He is allowing Satan to make you suffer, or your actions to make you suffer. He is not doing it. He didn't do this to Job. He let Satan do this to Job. Right? It's not God punishing you. He's allowing it to happen. So God allowed Satan to have power over Job. I'm not going to read verses 14 through 22. It would take too long. You all hopefully know the story. Satan took away his cattle, his livestock, his family, everything. Right? Everything except his wife. Took it all away from him. God allowed that to happen to Job. But he was an incredible man, wasn't he? And Satan set it up to be as painful as possible. You know, how you think about losing one family member, how about all of them? Talk about pain. And Job was an upright man. Job didn't do anything to deserve it. Remember what God said? He said he was blameless. He was upright and he feared God and shunned evil. Why would God allow that? Well, we know what happened next, right? Satan says, well, that didn't work so well, did it? It didn't happen the way I thought it would happen. Job didn't do what I thought he would do and resent and reject God. And so he comes down to this, gives Job this loathsome illness, right? The boils over his entire body, where he goes into an ash heap and scrapes him with a potsherd. Probably the most miserable life I could think of, being in that position. The pain that he would have to endure. But let's go to Job 3. Job chapter 3 and verse 1. Because we see Job finally comes to maybe some senses. Job chapter 3 verse 1. Or does he? After this, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. I could understand that in being the way he was, scraping boils. I mean, I would want to die. That's what he wanted to do. He wanted to die. He didn't want to be here. Isn't that an understandable feeling? Anybody else? I won't have you raise your hands. Been in a position at times you just wanted to die? I'll admit, I had. Not a good position to be in. But this is where Job was. And of course, then his friends come along. And wow, yeah, good friends. Right? You wish you had friends like these guys. They imagine, as human beings often do, right? They imagine that, and we do this in the church, is that if we see something bad happening to someone, they must have sinned. Right? That happens in the church. He had to have done something wrong. He had to have. It's his fault that this is happening to him. And many times we're wrong if we think that. I know that's true because somebody said that about my son when he died. What did you do that he died? So I know that happens. Bad things happen to good people. Sometimes it's a part of a human existence and the human experience. And God does not protect us from all of those things. He does promise to help us in trials. He promises to help us turn, hopefully to eventually doing good things. But he doesn't say he'll shield us from every difficult and painful situation that comes along in life. Job finally gets around to really saying what he'd been thinking. No doubt, again, probably for some time. He said, God, you know, you're not being fair. You're not being fair here. This isn't fair. What you're doing to me, what's happening to me? Let's look at this in Job chapter 31. Job 31 and verse 35. Now remember, God said all this about Job, all these good things about Job. How he was a stand-up, upright guy. And here's Job now, turning around and saying, oh, that I had someone to hear me. Really? Has God not been there the whole time? Here is my mark. Oh, that the Almighty would answer me, that my prosecutor had written a book. He's probably saying, you know what, I'd like to really know what I deserved or supposedly did to deserve this. And eventually what Job was really saying is, God, this isn't fair. You owe me an explanation. I mean, right, we expect that. I mean, he wants to understand. And how did God respond to that? Let's go to Job 38. Job chapter 38 and verse 1. We'll begin there. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, now right there, I'd have been on my knees. Coming out of the whirlwind, I would think, I did it now. And he said, who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Now prepare yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. How did I create the universe, Job? You tell me that. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it? To where? What were its foundations fastened? Come on, smart guy. Or who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? Or who shut in the sea with doors when it burst forth and issued from the womb? When I made the clouds its garment and thick darkness its swaddling band? When I fixed my limit for it and set bars and doors? When I said, this far you may come, but no further, and here your proud waves must stop. Have you commanded the morning since your days began? You commanded the morning since your days began. He's asking Job this. Can you make the sun rise, Job? Can you handle the heavenly bodies that are out there and make them go in order that the way they are supposed to? He didn't say, well, sit down, Job. Let's have a little discussion. Let's just talk about this. Let me explain a few things. You see, you've got this little self-righteousness in you that I think we need to take care of and we need to work on. And that this lesson is for future generations. This is for not you. This is for future generations. That's why this is happening. He's basically saying, you're going to have to trust me. Right? You trust me. So we come back to what? The element of faith that we just talked about a little bit ago. The element of faith. Having faith in God. And you know what? When Job really got it, it was sufficient. Let's go to Job 42. Job 42, verse 1. Job 42, beginning verse 1, it says, then Job answered the Lord and said, I know that you can do everything, and that no purpose of yours can be withheld from you. You asked, who is this who hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore I have uttered what I did not understand. And then when we start complaining about the way God does things, we're getting into an area that we simply don't understand. We don't understand why. Only God does. Things too wonderful for me, which I do not know. Listen, please, and let me speak. You said, I question you, and you shall answer me. I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. I get it now. I understand. I know what you're trying to do. Therefore, I abhor myself in dust, and I repent in dust and ashes. Job says, I was wrong for even questioning you. But now I understand. Now I get it. I'll stop complaining and trust you and rely on you for the help that you, I know that you can give me, that I can get through this life and face things on my own. And I think that is the important part, brethren, that we have to understand. The key for all of us is when we're facing difficult circumstances, know He's there for us. When we really have our eyes fixed on how God is, how far above us He is, how amazing and marvelous His plan is, how magnificent it all is, and how incredibly simple at the same time. Then we'll trust Him to work things out. If He could set the incredible universe in motion and do all the things that He has going on around us, I mean, think about that. If He can do all that, then He can take care of us, can He? He gives us privileges and the privilege of participating in what He's doing. We're being a part of that. And even in cases where God allows final extremity to arrive at someone's life, even in the case where someone dies prematurely, there are scriptures that say God is there. Right? He is there, and He's watching over what happens. He's watching what we do. He's watching what we react. And that our lives are in His hands until the point where He allows this physical existence to end. Philippians chapter 1:16, verse 15. You don't need to turn there. I'll just give you that. Philippians 1:16 and verse 15 says, "Precious in the sight of the Lord is the death of His saints." That's something that God takes very seriously. He doesn't let things like that happen at the time to frustrate any part of the plan for us individually. That's not what He's trying to do. That would be bad for us in the long run. All things, again, it says all things work together for good for those who love God and are called according to His purpose. We have to believe that. Let's go to Isaiah 57. Isaiah chapter 57. And verse 1. This is a scripture read a lot of times during funerals because it indicates that sometimes God allows a death to intervene to save someone for something worse happening later on. He does. He does. But again, those are things we don't know, we don't understand, but we trust that He does. Right? We trust that. Isaiah 57, verse 1, "The righteous perishes, and no man takes it to heart. Merciful men are taken away, while no one considers that the righteous is taken away from evil." So even in this case, which happens for some people who lose loved ones, and we all have probably at some point lost a loved one because of accidents or illness, that doesn't mean God has turned away. It doesn't mean that. He's still intimately involved in every second of your life. God knows the things that we can and cannot understand now. That's the lesson. Or I think one of the lessons that we can take from the book of Job. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't try to improve our lot, does it? Doesn't mean we shouldn't try to improve ourselves. We shouldn't, you know, as I was brought up in the other sermon, is to become better, perfect, right? Doesn't mean we shouldn't be doing that along the way. We should. Let's go to Philippians chapter 4. Philippians chapter 4. What should we do to make our situations better? Help ourselves as we are able. Right? Help ourselves if we are able, but we shouldn't if we aren't able to improve the situation as much as we want to escape from that difficulty. We shouldn't allow it to make us bitter or angry. And sometimes that happens, doesn't it? We try to improve it, and then something happens, and we become bitter, we become angry, because it didn't work out the way we wanted it to. Philippians 4, verse 10 says, "But I rejoiced in the Lord greatly now that at last your care for me has flourished again. Though you surely did care, but you lacked opportunity." The Philippian church often sent financial reports to Paul in his ministry. They sent assistance. They sent financial support for him in his ministry. They did this. So he thanked them for it. He says, now that I speak in regard to need, or not that I do, for I have learned in whatever state I am to be content. I know how to be abased. I know how to be abound. He knew how to live with plenty or a little or none. Everywhere and in all things, I have learned both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. I can do all things with Christ through Christ who strengthens me. You'll learn that while I'm here. That is my favorite scripture. And I believe that from my head to my toes. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. It may not be the way I want all the time, but I can do it. Yes, we have to and we should try to improve our situations if we're able to. But we must accept whatever it is we get without bitterness, without anger, without contempt for God, without retaliation, because He knows what's best. You know, if the situation would harm us in the long run, God would stop it. I believe God would stop it. If it was going to affect us in the long run and harm us, He would change it. He would intervene immediately, just like Paul said, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. So whatever we are, whatever circumstance we find ourselves in, our Father expects us to be about our business, about His business, of being Christians, about growing in grace and knowledge, serving, helping one another, helping His church, and being a light. We can't feel like our involvement in whatever we're doing depends on exterior circumstances. Right? Because the ideal circumstances will never come. God expects us to be about the business of Christians wherever we are. Let's go to 1 Corinthians 12. Because it says that God has placed us exactly where He wants us to be. He knows where we are. We need to consider this chapter in light of the question we're talking about. Is God fair? Because we're all a part of the body. All of us. And some parts of the body wish they were other parts of the body. Apparently. 1 Corinthians 12 and verse 15. 1 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 15. If the foot should say, because I am not a hand, I am not of the body, it is therefore not of the body. And if the ear were to say, because I am not an eye, I am not of the body, is it therefore not of the body? If the whole body were an eye, where would the hearing be? If the whole were hearing, where would this be the smelling? But now God has set the members, each one of them, in the body just as He pleased. He knows where you are. He knows what circumstances are in your life. He called us, and He knows what our life circumstances can be like. He knows what our marriages are like. He knows what our jobs are like. He knows what our families are like. He knows what our health situation is like. He knows all of that. And He could change things if one of those things were going to be a detriment to us. In fact, He promised that, didn't He? All things work together for good. God is preparing a place for us. And it says that in John chapter 14. Let's go there. John chapter 14. John 14, verse 2. John chapter 14, verse 2 says, in my Father's house are many mansions. Now, it does not say these are huge mansions with 22 or 30 rooms. Okay? It's not what it's saying. It means dwellings. It means abodes. It means offices or positions. That's what He's talking about. In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you. So God is preparing different places, different positions, different responsibilities, and different opportunities for service for each one of us. There will be individual dwelling places, or you call them posts, or offices for each one of us. And so each one of us, our needs are slightly different. And the training we're going to get is slightly different because the positions are likely to be different. So it doesn't matter what somebody else is going to get or have. You're being trained for what you're going to have. So we don't need to compare. We don't need to worry about them getting ahead of us. God has a special place that he is preparing for you and me. And the Bible uses different analogies when we go through it for the church as a temple. Let's go to 1 Peter 2. No, sorry, I don't want to go there. I'll give you that. 1 Peter 2 and verse 5. Don't turn there. We're going to go by that one. But he calls us there living stones. Right? Living stones that make up the temple. And there are interesting parallels with the temple that God is creating and something that happened when Solomon's temple was being constructed. Let's go to 1 Kings chapter 6. First Kings chapter 6, verse 7. First Kings 6 and verse 7. And the temple, when it was being built, was built with stone finished at the quarry, so that no hammer or chisel or iron tool was heard in the temple while it was being built. Now think about that. All the materials, right, for construction were done someplace else. They were hewn someplace else. The stone, the wood, whatever materials that were being used were all done someplace else and then brought in and constructed the temple using no tools, nothing at all, chisels to make them fit. They all fit. That's pretty amazing when we want to think about that. When we look at that, we're living stones. God is chipping away at us, isn't he? God is molding us and fashioning us and getting the proper measurements for us because we're a part of that temple, are we not? We're stones to bring us all together in his kingdom so that we fit each one together as a temple whole. It doesn't matter what situations we are in. It doesn't. Because God will work with us in our own circumstances, individually. And we're all going to participate together in harmony and cooperation with the family and the kingdom of God. Well, in closing, let's go to Hebrews chapter 6. Hebrews chapter 6. I find this a really encouraging verse, one that I try to keep in my mind. It says, "Beloved," I said, "but beloved, we are confident of better things concerning you." Yes. Things that accompany salvation, though we speak in this manner. For God is not unjust to forget your work and labor of love which you have shown toward his name, and that you have ministered to the saints and do minister. So it says here, God is not unjust to forget the work and your labor. That's very encouraging, isn't it? It is to me, because God doesn't forget anything we do in his service to him and for him. He said that would be an unjust thing for him, right? Unjust. And our great God in heaven is not unjust. He doesn't forget our efforts in all the things that we do. He doesn't forget them. And I'm convinced that God remembers all the good things that we have done for him in his efforts that you have forgotten over these many years. Each is rewarded according to his works. We know salvation is a free gift. There's nothing we can do to earn that. But the positions of service we will have in his kingdom will be determined, right? Will be determined in part by our labor, which God does not forget. He doesn't forget the trials that we go through. Remember that. He doesn't forget those. He doesn't forget how hard we've worked in this life to serve Him. How we struggle to submit our will to Him. He doesn't forget any of that. None of it escapes His attention. He knows what we're going through, and we should have confidence that He is going to do the best thing for each one of us in our lives. So let me come back to the question in the beginning. Is God fair? Well, I hope that we can see that there's actually a problem with that question. That's not the way we should be dealing with this issue, because God is not just fair. He goes way beyond fair. Because along with fairness comes mercy and love and forgiveness. He goes way past fairness. God has done and is doing and has promised to do far more for all of us in this life than we could say is just fair. We deserve nothing. Right? We deserve nothing. And He's promised to see that we will have everything. Everything. He promises us that. So you and I can be very thankful that our wonderful Father in heaven is so far beyond fair.